Welcome to Whiskey Cast, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 313 for April 24th, 2011. Coming up in a few minutes.
I hated the taste of whiskey, but you just had to get used to it, because that was, if you were going to stand with the men in the bar, you had to tuck your drum, you know?
Veteran whiskey writer Charles McLean is marking his 30th anniversary of writing about whiskeys this year. He's been a keeper of the Quake since 1992 and was elevated to the rank of Master of the Quake in 2009. Charles and I sat down to talk recently in Edinburgh, and you'll hear our conversation in a few minutes. I'll also have the calendar of events, the emails of the week, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department. First off, let's look at the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. We heard from Tomatin master distiller Douglas Campbell a couple of weeks ago as he celebrated his 50th anniversary in the business. Douglas actually gave up the role of distillery manager a couple of years ago, and Tomatin has finally found his successor. Graham Yunson will move over from Glenglassaugh to take up the day-to-day reins on August 1st, while Douglas will continue as master distiller and brand ambassador for Tomatin. Graham has been the manager at Glenglassaugh for the last 3 years, and before that he was Glenmorangie's distillery manager for 12 years. No word on who will take over for him at Glenglassaugh. I've mentioned the growth in whiskey tourism over the last several years, and we have some new data now to back that up. Diageo has released data for its 12 distilleries in Scotland that have full-fledged visitor centers. Total visits rose 19% between 2008 and 2010, with around 210,000 visitors to the 12 distilleries last year. Talisker was the most popular distillery to visit, with 50,550 visits last year. Foreign visitors made up 59% of the traffic, with Germany, France, the U.S., and Spain accounting for the most visitors. U.K. tourists accounted for 41% of the visits. Now, let's put those Talisker numbers into perspective. Keep in mind that the Isle of Skye isn't exactly easy to reach. Isle of Arran Distillery in La Cranza reported 68,000 visitors last year in its annual report, which also showed a 27% gain in profits and a 42% increase in sales. By the way, Arran's annual open day is set for May 29th. We don't have current visitor data available for some of the larger distilleries in Scotland with visitors' centers, but as those numbers come out, I'll be glad to report them here. The UK is preparing for elections on May 5th, and if one were allowed to vote outside one's home district, the polls in the parish of Rowdham and Larling might well become a popular place to vote. That's because this will be the first election to use the English Whiskey Company's distillery as the local polling site. In the past, elections there have used a mobile polling station, but the distillery offers a few key amenities like parking, access for the disabled, restrooms, and, of course, whiskey in the visitor's center. Lincoln Henderson's Angel's Envy bourbon is still being rolled out in some U.S. markets, but there's word that Lincoln's already preparing for a sequel. The Louisville Courier-Journal reports this week that Lincoln is working on a barrel-proof version of Angel's Envy that could be out in time for the holidays. It's being aged exclusively in port wine casks, which means it won't be able to legally be called a bourbon. Bonhams, meanwhile, held its latest whiskey auction in New York last week, and a complete set of the Bowmore 1964 Trilogy led the bidding, with a hammer price of $21,420. A 55-year-old Macallan sold for $20,230, and a 57-year-old bottle of Macallan sold for slightly more than $19,000. A bottle of 50-year-old Glenfiddich received a high bid of $17,850. The next Bonhams whiskey auction is set for May 24th in Hong Kong. McTeers will hold its next whiskey auction in Glasgow, May 11th. And finally, a correction to report. In the last episode, I mentioned the Macallan's Royal Wedding Limited Edition bottling, which used two casks from 1996 and 1999. I said last time around those were the birth years for Prince William and Kate Middleton. I was dead wrong. In fact, if I'd been right, we'd be seeing a couple of teenagers getting married this week and some scandal to boot, most likely. The two were both born in 1982. That's the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie, unnecessarily well-made. A couple of program notes now. I'll be on the road again during the next couple of weeks. Buffalo Trace will be unveiling a new bourbon this week in Kentucky. I'll be in Frankfort for the announcement, and I'll have the full story next time around. Now, the following week, Irish Distillers plans to introduce a couple of new pot still whiskies to join Redbreast and Greenspot in its new single pot still whiskies of Ireland range that I mentioned on the show a couple of weeks ago. The announcement will be at the Old Middleton Distillery in County Cork, and I'll be making the quick trip over to bring you the story 2 weeks from now. Let's check out the emails of the week, brought to you by Highland Park. Dave Tanton in Colorado emailed me the other day, and he needs some help, and I need some help from you now. Dave is trying to find a source for those dark blue Copita-style nosing glasses that are used in many distillery blending labs. I have not been able to find a U.S. source for him yet, even after contacting several distilleries. I posted this request on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page during the week. Lavinia Turnbull in Scotland suggested a Dutch online retailer. Unfortunately, that retailer won't ship to the U.S. If you know of a place that sells these special nosing glasses and will ship to the U.S., please let me know. I'll pass the info on to Dave. By the way, just because somebody asked this question on the Facebook page, and I know somebody else will be asking it soon, why use dark blue glasses? Well, they're good for comparing different types of whiskeys because the dark blue can mask the color differences that can come from using different types of casks, and it forces the noser to rely even more on the sense of smell. Now, I heard from David Kroll in Japan this week as well. David is a partner in the number one drinks company with March & Miller, and David is also the publisher of the Japanese edition of Whiskey Magazine. He wanted to follow up on the discussion last time around with Chris Bunting. Chris and I discussed the aftermath of the Japanese earthquake and the issues that have been raised about radiation coming from the nuclear power plants in the Sendai region. Here's what David had to say. The radiation issue is obviously a very sensitive one with your listeners who enjoy Japanese whiskey, and, by its very nature, one which invites rumor and speculation as it cannot easily be detected without specialist equipment, with some countries having imposed partial bans or testing requirements on the import of Japanese products. We wanted to be as proactive as possible in ensuring that the whiskies we export have been unaffected by the ongoing incident at Fukushima. We therefore voluntarily submitted samples from Kuruizawa, Kawasaki, Hanyu, and Chichibu distilleries to a government-approved testing center. I just wanted to give you a heads up that the results have come in and show that the three radionuclides involved, iodine-131, cesium-134, and cesium-137, were undetected in all the samples we submitted, a completely clean bill of health. David, thank you for the update. I should note that Nika's Miyagikyo distillery is also in the area near the reactors, and David's report does not include data on samples from Miyagikyo. However, I'd be very surprised if testing showed any impact there as well. If you have a question or a suggestion, I'd love to hear from you. My email address is comments@whiskeycast.com, and you can also post your comments at the WhiskeyCast Facebook page. The emails of the week are brought to you this time around by Highland Park.
Hello, this is Jerry Tosh of Highland Park, the makers of the best spirit in the world. If you'd like to go onto the WhiskeyCast website and click on the banner, then it'll take you to the inner circle and sign up, and we'll send you as much information about Highland Park as you'd ever need to know.
Time now for the calendar of events, brought to you as always by Laphroaig. The Tolbooth Tavern in Edinburgh, Scotland will host a Jolly Topper tasting of Tom and Tool single malts on the 28th. Try saying that three times fast. Just as the Spirit of Speyside Festival gets underway, and it runs through May 2nd. Binney's in Highland Park, Illinois will host a Glenlivet tasting April 29th. The Scotch Malt Whiskey Society's Australian chapter will hold a members tasting in Sydney on May 6th. The Society's U.S. chapter will hold its final single malt extravaganza of the spring May 12th in Denver. By the way, the fall schedule of extravaganzas is out now. You can get tickets at the members' price by using the promo code WC11 when you order them online. The Manhattan Cocktail Classic runs May 13th through the 17th in New York City with a number of whiskey tastings and events on the schedule. The Spirit of Toronto Festival is May 14th, along with Whiskey Live Dublin. The Limburg Whiskey Fair is May 14th and 15th in Limburg, Germany. And Whiskey Live Singapore is May 18th. There is a complete calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig. Just click the Laphroaig banner at the WhiskeyCast website to become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Islay. This week's WhiskeyCast In Depth is brought to you by Glengarry. I was walking down the books and magazines aisle of my local supermarket the other day when I saw yet another book by Charles MacLean. It stood out because it's the first whiskey book I've ever seen on those shelves. In fact, Great Whiskies is an edited guide to some 500 different whiskies derived from World Whiskey, which Charles served as the editor-in-chief for back in 2009. As I mentioned earlier, Charles is also one of the few people honored as a Master of the Quake. He's also a member of the Malt Maniacs and travels around the world to lead tastings and spread the word about whiskey. He was part of Gordon and MacPhail's Glenlivet 70 launch last month, and after the event in Edinburgh, we sat down to talk.
I wrote my first job for the whiskey industry exactly 30 years ago, 1981, for Bell's. At that time, I was a freelance copywriter. And during the 80s, and also writing books about Scottish history, Scottish social history, this sort of stuff, Words for Cash. And the during the 80s, I did a lot of work for a number of whiskey companies, notably Highland, Glenmorangie, and then United Distillers. When Guinness took over the distillers company, I wrote a lot of material for them in the very early days. And by 1988, I had sufficient track record and sufficient interest in the subject, whiskey, to make a fist of a proposal to a publisher for a book about whiskey, which was adjusted and accepted, and that book appeared in 92. And really, since then, my career took a body swerve towards whiskey and away from other forms of writing. So it was, in effect, it was by chance.
How many books have you written?
Well, they kindly said 14 books about Scotch. In truth, I think I'm right in saying that I've done 12 under my own name, and I've been managing editor of a further three. So it's something along those sorts of lines. And I've written about, I think, eight or nine other books, which have long disappeared, by the way. You can't get them anymore, but on other subjects.
But why whiskey in the first place back in 1981? What drew you to it?
Starvation. I always like to have a book on the back burner as a commercial writer, independent writer, to turn to when times were hard, and this seemed like, as I say, I had sufficient interest by that time, and it seemed it was a subject that I wanted to research further, but that's what it was, you know, sort of the need for income.
But how did you get into whiskey in general? Did you have a family background?
Yeah, I mean, brought up in Scotland, you know. I mean, I was when one became a man, when one could stand at the bar with the good old boys. I was brought up on the Isle of Arran, and the standing at the bar with the farmers and the fishermen, you'd start with beer, and then at a certain time they would switch to whiskey, or half and half, you know, half pint of beer and a nip, and whether you liked it or not, you drank. It was all blended Scotch, and you know, as a young lad of say 17, 18, you know, I hated the taste of whiskey, but you just had to get used to it, because that was, if you were going to stand with the men in the bar, you had to tuck your dram, you know. And so I got, my father was a great whiskey drinker. My whole family, you know, they enjoyed whiskey. My dad actually, he always had malt whiskey in the house, but he would favor blended Scotch, as everybody did in those days. We're talking, you know, late 60s, and so that was how I got acquired a taste for whiskey. So I was familiar. I was very, very friendly. Interesting enough, this Glenlivet, my best friend at school and later at university was Charlie Grant, whose father, Russell Grant, was the owner of Glenlivet Distillery. And so I knew Glenlivet. I went up there in the late 60s. I think we talked about this when we were up at Glenlivet. Yeah. And the I tasted Glenlivet from the late 60s, or probably made in the 1950s. At that time, so I was acquainted with the taste of malt whiskey from about then, But I couldn't say that I was a passionate whiskey drinker probably until the early 70s when I was at university and then began to drink heavily, as I have done ever since.
How did you develop your nosing skills?
Oh.
That's a question I get asked a lot, yeah. And I bow to your expertise on this. How did you develop your skills as a nose that have really progressed and developed over 30 years?
Well, the simple answer to that is practice. But I started with a huge advantage in that I did a formal training with what's now the Scotch Whisky Research Institute in 1992 and benefited from the wisdom of Jim Swan and Sheila Birtles in particular, who were Pentland Scotch Whisky Research Institute, and they were part of the team that devised the aroma wheel, the flavor wheel, the Pentland's wheel, as it was called. And that just changed my life altogether. And I was working on my first book at the time, and the publisher required tasting notes for all the malts, not the blends. And that was hugely helpful. And so I had this firm sort of scientific, if you like, or quasi-scientific background, which equipped me to assess and evaluate whiskies ever since then.
How do you go through a whiskey? When you're becoming acquainted, say, as you were with this Glenlivet 70-year-old from Gordon and MacPhail, how do you assess a whiskey?
Well, first I look at the color. The color tells me a great deal. I was looking at a flight of whiskies yesterday, about 30 single cask samples, and you could more or less tell just by looking at them which ones were likely to be any good. In other words, if a whiskey, some of these 20-year-old whiskies, and they were still incredibly pale, they were as pale as tarnished silver, you know, and you just know that that whiskey's been drawn from a cask which is exhausted, and so it needs to be re-racked or rejected. Depends whether this was for an independent bottler and whether they want to bottle now or whether they want to re-rack and then leave it for another 3 to 5 years in a very active cask. So the appearance tells you a great deal. It sets up expectations, but it also tells you whether the cask has been good to the whiskey, you know. And you can get an incredibly dark color in 3 years, as you know, in a very active cask.
Right.
But what you can, if the cask is as pale as anything in 15 years, then the whiskey is pale as anything, the cask is exhausted. So that's the first thing. Then I always give it a vigorous shake, and I pour the sample. I give it a vigorous shape, and I look at the beading, the bubbles. And that tells me about strength, because you only get beading over about 50% alcohol. So this, if I'm doing it blind, I don't know the strength of the whiskey. It may be when I'm judging competitions, for example, where the samples come blind and they're bottle samples. I mean, they come from bottle product, but that will give me the clues to whether the thing is cask strength or whether it's bottling strength under 50%. So I'll look at the beading. If the beading lingers, that's indicating texture. It's indicating mouthfeel effect. So a plus sign. So beading is a good thing, high strength and texture. Then I will nose the whiskey at full strength, and then depending upon, and I'll take my notes, then my main notes will be taken then. Then I'll taste it, a very small amount, usually taste it at full strength, usually taste and spit, and sometimes take a mouthful of water, then taste. And then I will add a little bit of water. Now that amount of water depends entirely on whether you take off the nose feel effect, take off any prickle, open up the whiskey, make it easier to taste in the mouth. Yeah. Then I'll taste again, and sometimes I'll write my major tasting notes at that stage at reduced. I'll always comment on taste. If I'm doing a lot of whiskies, then I'll spit again and drink water in between times. If I'm doing a reasonable flight, then I'll swallow the whiskey. Interesting enough, at many competitions, things or general tastings, spittoons are not always set with wine tastings, but not necessarily with whiskey tastings. So then I'll set it aside, so I'll have completed my notes by that time. I'll carry on, maybe look at, I don't like going more than about 6 whiskies at a sitting, and sometimes less, actually. But then I'll go back, once I've completed the others, we'll go back and then look at the development, look at the nose, see how the nose has changed for good or bad. Usually won't taste at that stage in the development. And then in many cases I will be asked to, or sometimes just for my own pleasure, I will mark it out of 10. Where, you know, it, well, in terms of buying a cask, where, you know, six, if you like, five and a half is a five is a kind of possible, six is a perfect, is a purchase, but seven and eight are very good whiskies. Nine, I probably find, gosh, once a year, you know, and 10 only in heaven. Never a 10.
You've also progressed not only from writing about whiskeys, but to also serving as a consultant, serving as a blender, helping others make their own whiskeys or produce their own whiskeys for bottling. How did you make that transition? I know you've worked with the folks at Weems and some other folks along the line in terms of creating bottlings for the public.
Well, I haven't actually done that except in single cask bottlings. Right. I've had input in making blended whiskies, but only small. In that the you know, buying a ready-made blend and then adjusting it slightly to draw out one characteristic or another. So most of that sort of consultancy, rather grand word, is to do with cask selection, recommending just exactly what we've talked about, whether I recommend, and usually I'm sitting with the client, whether it be Adelphi or Weems or other people, whether they should buy that particular cask or not, that on that sort of level. I couldn't really describe myself as a whiskey maker in the same way that John Glazer or any blender is a distillery manager is a whiskey maker, you know.
What's your biggest gripe about the business these days? What don't you like?
I couldn't possibly say. No, I honestly, you give me pause for thought there, because the nothing, frankly, springs to mind. I don't have any major gripes, in other words, at the moment.
Okay, what's the industry doing right?
Selling an awful lot of whiskey, keeping me in a job. I think that there are pressures on the industry. There are always pressures when, you know, with success. In that, I think that some wood is getting very expensive. Then, by and large, so far as I'm aware, they're not speeding up production procedures, which would have an impact on flavor. Wood is getting expensive. I think that maybe casks are being used a bit too much. In some cases, I notice a slight change and sometimes deterioration in the flavor profile of some standard whiskies, whether they be blends or 10-year-old, 12-year-old malts. I'm not mentioning any names, but and I imagine this is because the whiskies being taken out of, younger whiskies are being used in a blend, for example. But that's what happens when a particular brand takes off. I can't really think of anything else that. And what you said, what are they doing right? Well, one thing they're doing right is making available to us more expressions of particularly malt whiskey, but to some extent blended Scotch as well. More expressions than ever before in history. I mean, I was mentioning today that the in 1970 Wallace Milroy could find only four proprietary bottled single malt whiskies in 1970, and the malt whiskey yearbook, last year's malt whiskey yearbook, in their list of expressions bottled in 1900 and no sorry 2000 and were they looking 2010 it was yeah it was the, it was the 2011 edition, right. Looking back to 2010, and they had a cutoff at 500, you know, and they said that it was impossible to keep track of the number of expressions bottled, and so they limited it to 500 expressions in a year in the year 2010, whereas there were only four proprietary bottlings and, let's say, about, say, 300 bottlings available overall in 1970.
And when you look at the 1,400 or so that Jim Murray tasted last year for the Whiskey Bible,
yeah.
Are we really at what people would call a golden age for whiskey?
I believe so. In terms of certainly in terms of the range, in terms of quality, that is a different question. And of course, it's impossible to tell But this is what, again, back to the 70-year-old Glenlivet, this is why it's so fascinating, tasting whiskies made before all the big changes in the 1960s and 70s. And, you know, in many ways, I was tasting some young 8-year-old whiskies, but made in the 1960s recently, and they were absolutely fantastic, you know? And so in some cases, I mean, I know that quality control is greater, far, far greater now than it was then, but, you know, somehow the flavors are, they're certainly different and, dare I say it, better.
Are we putting too much emphasis on computers and automation and consistency rather than having an individual stillman working the stills and knowing just when to make that cut?
I think so. I mean, the consistency has been the bugbear, or the obsession of the Scotch whisky industry since the 1890s. Consistency rather necessarily than interesting flavors and, well, loosely quality. I mean, quality and consistency go hand in glove, but the and I think that, you know, the perhaps the judgment of the individual craftsman might make a difference rather than the defined consistent flavor defined by the company, defined by the computer.
Last question. Can you imagine ever writing about anything other than whiskey?
I don't have the imagination, I don't think. I would love to, but in the meantime, I have no plans to.
What's your next project?
I'm involved in two or three projects, well, three projects at the moment, which are currently secret. But these are commercial projects, and they've taken over from private thing. I'm updating my Whiskypedia at the moment. I have to go to the publisher on Thursday, to 2 days' time, to input all the changes since, well, a year and a half ago. And there are many changes even in that time. And I have got another book project, which is sort of on the stocks, but I won't be able to turn to it for some months. But thank you for asking.
Great Whiskies is available not only at my local grocery store, but at good booksellers and the WhiskeyCast store, powered by Amazon.com, too. This week's WhiskeyCast In-Depth is brought to you by Glengarry, non-chill filtered, full Highland character. Charles mentioned his work on selecting casks for the Weems Malts whiskies. I mentioned the new 8-year-old versions of the Weems Smooth Gentleman and Pete Chimney whiskies last time around. And since Charles had a key role in selecting the casks for both blended malts, let's start off the What I'm Tasting This Week department with them. The Smooth Gentleman is blended around a Highland single malt, bottled at 40% ABV. The nose has notes of dark chocolate, roasted almonds, and dried orange peel. The taste is rich and slightly tart, with a note of blood oranges, a hint of lemon, and chocolate. The finish has a slight tartness along with a hint of heather and lingers nicely. It lives up to its name. I'm scoring the Weems Malts Smooth Gentleman an 84. Now, as you might expect, the Pete Chimney is focused around an Isla malt. It's also bottled at 40%. The nose has subtle smoky notes of burnt leaves, a touch of brine, and if you leave it in the glass for a few minutes, a touch of lemon peel turns up as well. The taste has a smooth peatiness with creosote and tar notes that don't overwhelm the slight lemony tartness underneath. The finish is moderately smoky and very slow to fade. I'm scoring the Weems Malts Pete Chimney an 87. Finally, I received a sample of the Glenmorangie Pride 1981 at the end of this week. As we heard a couple of weeks ago in episode 311, this is an unusually rare Glenmorangie, with only 1,000 Baccarat crystal decanters available worldwide. As the name indicates, it was distilled in 1981 and aged for the first 18 years in American white oak. Around that time, Dr. Bill Lumsden was able to acquire some Sauternes casks from France's legendary Chateau de Chem and put this whiskey into those casks for another 10 years. It's bottled at a cask strength 57.6% ABV, and the word that describes it is complex. The nose has notes of coconut, pears, vanilla, and toasted oak. The taste is full of cloves, nutmeg, coconut, and has some touches of pineapple and hazelnut underneath. The finish is rich, spicy, very long, with additional touches of lemon, vanilla, and mint. If you add some water to this one, it brings out even more complexity, with touches of roasted almonds and chestnuts to boot. I'm giving the Glenmorangie Pride 1981 a score of 94. Now you'll find all of my tasting notes in the free WhiskeyCast apps for iPhone, iPad, and Android. The iPhone and iPad version is brought to you by the Glenrothes, and the Android version is sponsored by Ben Romick. They're also available at the WhiskeyCast website. That's also where you can find links to the WhiskeyCast Facebook page and my Twitter feed, along with the calendar of events, the WhiskeyCast store, powered by Amazon.com, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is www.whiskeycast.com. And send your emails to comments@whiskeycast.com. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2011. And it comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.